It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Capital Punishment in the United States, a botched execution by lethal injection in the U.S. state of Oklahoma that drew worldwide attention and criticism, is renewing a fierce debate over the death penalty in America. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In April, Oklahoma's Department of Corrections says inmate Clayton Lockett was issued the first of the state's three-drug lethal injection. But instead of dying peacefully, the convicted rapist and murderer began breathing heavily and clenching his teeth. After things started to go wrong, state officials lowered the blinds on the death chamber windows and obscured what happened next. After 43 minutes, he died of a heart attack. This was not the first time, or even the first time this year, that a lethal injection failed to kill a convict humanely. It also happened in January in the state of Ohio. So, will the Oklahoma case spark not only investigations into the drug protocol used in lethal injections, but also a debate on the merits of the death penalty in America? Opponents argue that the possibility of executing innocent people is just too real, and administering the death penalty, which often includes special treatment in prison and years of legal proceedings to ensure due process, too expensive. Advocates of capital punishment assert that it deters heinous crimes and is justified on cost, moral, and constitutional grounds. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, executions in the United States are actually decreasing due to costs, flawed prosecutions, and shortages of drugs needed to carry out lethal injections. Well, for more on the pros and cons of the death penalty and how it is administered in the United States, we turn to two experts on the matter. Diane Russ Tierney is the executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Previously, she served as the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Capital Punishment Project. And John Malcolm, he's director of and senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. That's a think tank here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, John Malcolm, let me begin with you. I'd like to get your reaction to this botched execution in Oklahoma, how it is changing the course of the debate over both methods and the merits of the death penalty.
Well, I don't know how it's going to change the course of debate. Obviously, what happened to Clayton Lockett should not have happened. I think that implementing the ultimate punishment is a somber and sober affair, and clearly one should determine what happened. I think at this point it's unclear what happened. Perhaps some forensic authorities know already, but it's unclear whether or not there was a problem with the three-drug cocktail that was employed by Oklahoma or whether there was a problem with the needle placement in Mr. Lockett's veins. Either way, what happened should not have occurred. I do think it's important, though, since no discussion of the death penalty, and you know, I believe Diane would agree with this, should be antiseptic, to at least remind your listeners what Clayton Lockett did, which is he and another individual named Angela Lockett, I presume his brother, and a third individual broke into a house. They gang raped a woman, a friend of Stephanie Neiman's. They then bound and gagged Stephanie Neiman and kidnapped her, another individual who's a male, and that male's friend's nine-month-old son. They then took them to a remote area, beat Stephanie Neiman. She stood by while a Confederate dug out a shallow grave. They then shot Stephanie Neiman, and although she was still alive, they buried her alive. Now, again, none of that is meant to discount what happened to Clayton Lockett. You know, maybe there are some people who are happy that Clayton Lockett suffered in his final moments. I'm not among them.
Well, I appreciate the context that you gave, John Malcolm. So turning to you, Diane Russ Tierney, of course, the crime that Clayton Lockett committed is heinous. But again, we have to look at the way in which the execution was done, and then we'll get into the larger question of the pros and cons of the death penalty. So just like to get your reaction to this, particularly the way in which the execution occurred, what we need to learn from this.
You know, John is absolutely right. I think, you know, sadly, these conversations happen in the context of So a horrible, horrible event. And so I think it is always important to remember that and to remember the families and what they've gone through. And I think that's what makes this sort of a difficult conversation at some level, because what the real focus has to be on the government's behavior. And I think when we talk about what happened in that execution, it goes beyond just the fact that there was obviously some kind of misstep with regard to administering the lethal drugs. This happened in a context where the government was misbehaving from the very beginning. You know, this is what happens when the government acts in secrecy and without accountability. And the lawyers for Mr. Clayton asked from the very beginning to let us know, what are these drugs? Let there be some sunlight shed on what was going to be done. And so what you had was the state of Oklahoma proceeding in haste without really knowing what they were doing. And so this is the result. And you had some very shocking things happen. At one point, the state Supreme Court issued a stay so that there could be some oversight and so that we perhaps could have even prevented what happened. And when the state Supreme Court did its job, the response of the legislature was to move to impeach the five justices that voted for the stay. On the heels of that, the governor in the state took the extraordinary step of saying, I'm not going to abide by the ruling of the Supreme Court. Go forward with the execution. And so under that kind of untoward pressure, the court lifted the stay, and so we have the result. So, you know, it is important to remember the context in which we're having this conversation, but the focus really has to be on government accountability and the limits of government authority.
Back to you, John Malcolm. Let's take a look at that, the government accountability in this case, going forward perhaps too hastily and using a cocktail of drugs perhaps which was not thoroughly tested. The way in which this lethal injection was administered is very troubling.
I would begin by saying that there is nothing hasty about the imposition of the death penalty. Death penalty opponents such as Diane and people who believe what she believes do a very effective job of delaying the implementation of the ultimate punishment for many years, often decades. So I think it's just not correct to say that things were done hastily. I would say with respect to the cocktail, the drugs that were going to be used, I believe, were known. What was not known was the identity of the compounding pharmacy that mixed the cocktail. A lot of organizations that used to provide drugs to carry out the death penalty have been harassed and have ultimately been shut down. I don't know whether there was a problem with this cocktail or not. I noticed, by the way, that there have been lethal injections carried out in many, many states without any problem whatsoever. And there are lots of opportunities to present legal challenges. I don't know whether or not the governor of Oklahoma made a statement about ignoring a court order. Obviously, I wouldn't condone any governor trying to ignore a court order. However, I think it is fair to say that Clayton Lockett had plenty of due process.
Maybe I was in error to use that word, but let me just quickly follow up with you before I turn back to Diane, which is a question that somebody in the audience might have, which is, why the secrecy? Why is it that the lethal injection is so problematic? One would think that for such a serious act, that is capital punishment, that there would be some kind of a standardized drug that's administered, that was tested, that would have, you know, immediate effect.
Well, one, as Diane said, states that still have the death penalty, and there are 32 of them, have a great deal of difficulty obtaining these drugs. There are reasons for that. So the last company, Hospira, that used to provide drugs used to carry out the death penalty decided that it just didn't want the bad publicity and didn't want its drugs used for that purpose, so they ceased making it. A lot of these drugs would then come from Europe. The European Union has prohibited the export of these drugs from countries that are part of the European Union. There are other pressures put on European countries. The Organization of European Cooperation and Development has made it a condition of joining that organization that the country must abolish the death penalty. And the FDA has put roadblocks in terms of obtaining these drugs from Asia, where there are companies willing to export these drugs. I would also note that professional licensing associations for doctors and nurses, reacting in part to pressure from death penalty opponents, have prohibited doctors and nurses from being involved in this process. And that does make carrying out the ultimate punishment, at least through a lethal injection, a difficult process. Again, I don't know in Oklahoma whether the problem was with the cocktail or with the needle placement in Mr. Lockett's veins. It should be looked into. It is being looked into. There was another execution scheduled for that night of an individual named Charles Warner, who raped and murdered his girlfriend's 11-month-old baby. that was put on hold. However, you know, these executions ought to be carried out in a safe, efficient manner. This is a somber moment, but I do think that if the citizens of a state have decided that the ultimate punishment ought to be imposed for the ultimate crime, it ought to be done in a humane way.
Turning back to you, Dan Russ Tierney, to talk about this lethal injection as a method. This is the most prevalent method in the United States now for death penalty. What other methods are used, if at all?
It is. I mean, I think it is the most prevalent. Let's back up and talk about how we got here. The first important thing to understand is that the United States is part of a dwindling number of democracies that have the death penalty. And that is because the rest of the world is coming to view the use of capital punishment as a sanction as a human rights violation. It is viewed in the same vein as torture. And so there is a growing international consensus against the use of the death penalty in the United States. And so the European Union and other states and companies that are based in those states are taking a moral stand in much the same way that the United States took a moral stand against apartheid and other human rights abuses. And so the rest of the world is really begging and urging the United States to step into the light of the human rights community. And so that is why these companies have made the decision that they do not want to participate in these executions. And so the shortage of drugs that we have is a result of that. And so what we have is states scrambling in a context where there's lessening and lessening support internationally and nationally for this practice to cobble together ways of killing people. Just another quick point, support for the death penalty continues to decrease as the public learns more about how it works in practice. At one point, when I first worked on this issue too many years ago, public support for the death penalty was at around 80%. It's now down to 55%. That's close to the amount of support there was for the death penalty when the Supreme Court ruled in 72 the death penalty was unconstitutional and there was a de facto moratorium. So the public opinion has shifted significantly. What we've also seen is that public opposition to the death penalty has increased and intensified. And so there are 37% of the public, we think somewhere around 90 million people in the United States, who oppose the death penalty. So this is happening because the death penalty is coming under justified criticism. And these states are responding, but responding in a way that's irresponsible.
All right, well, we're going to take a break, but I do want to commend you for making the connection between the scarcity of these drugs and therefore the inability perhaps to administer lethal injection in a more open and transparent way and, of course, the dwindling support for the death penalty in the world, and I guess based on your statistics here in the United States. But we'll get more on that in a minute. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Dan Russ Tierney. She's executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and John Malcolm. He's director of and senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank here in Washington. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the pros and cons of the death penalty in the United States in the aftermath of a botched execution in the south central state of Oklahoma, which sparked worldwide attention. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email with feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to you, John Malcolm. I know you wanted to get in a word edgewise.
Yeah. Diane said several things that I'd like to respond to. One is that support for the death penalty is weakening among democratic nations throughout the world. And I would point out that there are still several democratic nations, Thailand, India, Japan, Singapore, others that retain the death penalty. I would also point out that in this country, our Constitution clearly envisions the death penalty. It says that life, liberty, or property may not be taken with due process of law. In other words, if due process of law is carried out, life may be taken. I would note that with respect to European Union countries, that the death penalty actually has popular support in a number of European countries. However, the European Union has said that to remain in the Union, the country must abolish the death penalty, whether they would like to do so or not. And with respect to popular support in this country, so Diane cited the statistic that at one point point, support for the death penalty was at 80%. The support for the death penalty has, as with most contentious social issues, waxed and waned. Its high watermark was 80%. Its low watermark was 47%. I would note that according to the latest Gallup poll, support is not at 55%. It's, in fact, at 60%. And by the way, when you mention the facts of specific cases, facts of a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or of a Timothy McVeigh who did the Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people and wounded over 800 others, support for the death penalty skyrockets.
Back to you, Diane Rust Tierney. I know you are opposed to the death penalty. Are there any circumstances under which you think the death penalty could be justified, such as the Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma bombing here, or other heinous crimes?
Absolutely not. You know, it's one thing to think about the death penalty as an idea in the abstract, and the polls go back and forth. We cited the Gallup poll. The poll I'm talking about is a poll that was done by the Pew Trust Group. The problem that we're talking about here is the difficulty of administering the death penalty in practice in a way that's consistent with our other values. The Oklahoma execution was a graphic example of how we can't get it right at that stage, but we can't get it right from the very beginning. We have 144 people who've been released from death row because of innocence, and there was just a recent report released by the National Academy of Science that shows that 1 in 25 people that are sentenced to death are likely innocent. So it's one thing to say, yes, this person deserves it, but when you actually have to administer the system, which is the thing we're grappling with now, it just doesn't work. And as to the length of time that people are on death row, these exercises of going into court are not academic. We saw that specifically in Oklahoma. The question about revealing the nature of the drugs and the origin of the drugs was not an academic exercise. It was directly related to figuring out whether these kinds of disasters were going to happen. And so we have people on death row. We have ample evidence that we're making mistakes. And so there has to be an opportunity to actually go into court and look at these cases. And what we have now is a system where there really isn't adequate time to make sure that we're actually executing the right people.
Back to you, John Malcolm. There's some interesting points that Diane made, and that is, of course, the administration of the death penalty, which is very problematic, as we witnessed in this particular case, not to in any way justify the heinous crimes of the convict. But what about the number of innocents who are executed and cases that show that many mistakes can be made in this regard? And then, of course, the relationship between race and the death penalty.
Well, that's a lot to chew on. Diane said that the death penalty does not conform with her values. I would note, however, that a majority of people in this country, as well as the citizens of 32 states, plus the federal government and the U.S. military, by the way, that the death penalty does conform with their values. She pointed to a study, actually, that indicated that 4% or something like that of people who are convicted and sentenced to death turn out to be innocent. In fact, they're exonerated. Exonerated in some cases means innocence. It doesn't always mean innocence, but I will readily admit that through very good work done by organizations such as the Innocence Project, improvements in DNA testing, that thankfully there have been some innocent people who were originally sentenced to death who have been freed. There is a big difference, though, between people who have been sentenced to death who were innocent and people who have actually been executed who are innocent. The recent report that suggested that perhaps innocent people might have been put to death was just that, an extrapolation based on people who were sentenced to death. There have been nearly 1,400 people put to death since the moratorium was lifted in 1976, and there has been no definitive proof, despite Herculean efforts by organizations such as Diane's, that in fact an innocent person has been put to death. With respect to race, first of all, every study by death penalty opponents has come to the conclusion that the race of the defendant was an irrelevant fact with respect to imposing the death penalty. People have pointed to the statistic that African Americans make up roughly 12% of the population, but are about 42-43% of people who have been sentenced to death. Now, that may seem like a shocking statistic until you consider the fact that over 50% of people who are convicted of murder are African American. In terms of race, I would note that the overwhelming majority of murders in this country are intra-race. They are white people killing white people. They are black people killing black people. Black people are far more likely to be murderers and far more likely to be murder victims. Most death penalty cases are interracial, and they usually involve a murder that is committed in the process of committing another kind of violent felony, a rape and armed robbery. And unfortunately, there is far more in terms of these types of crimes, interracial offenses, far more black on white crime than there is white on black crime. I would also note that a lot more black on white crimes occurs in rural areas where the death penalty is more popular, and a lot of white on black crime takes place in urban areas where the death penalty is a lot less popular. So there are explanations for this so-called racial disparity.
Dan Rastierney.
There's a lot to unpack there. So let me start by sort of where we can agree. And David Baldus was a dear friend of mine. And one of the reasons I love David so much is because he really was scrupulous about making sure that you didn't overstate the case. And so one of the things that David did say was that overall, the strongest evidence of discrimination or bias was in race of the victim. And that is because the system values some lives more than others. And I think some of the explanation that John pointed to is kind of the reason. There's an assumption that intra-racial crimes are more aggravated. That is the way prosecutors treat them. But when you control for the kind of the actual elements of the crime, that what those so-called aggravating factors actually disappeared. And then the only thing left was race. And so, yes, that is the assumption that somehow when African-American or other person of color perpetrates a crime against a white victim, that it's more aggravated for some reason. But when you look at those same crimes committed intra-racially, you really don't see that as a real difference in how those cases are treated. So that assumption is kind of what drives what we've seen. So we do have a system that does value some lives more than others. And it is correct that victims of color are about 50% of the overall homicide victims. And that's why you have to look at the fact that 80% of the people who've been sentenced to death somewhere in that neighborhood is for the murder of white victims. So we do have a system that values some lives more than others. In North Carolina, there was a law that was passed called the Racial Justice Act, where defendants were able to challenge their death sentences based on evidence of discrimination. So we did see this race of victim discrimination. We also saw that jurors, qualified African Americans, were intentionally excluded from serving on juries because of their race. And so, you know, this system goes beyond the sentence. It's from who makes the decisions, who gets to sit in the jury box. And so it is a real problem that we have to confront.
May I briefly respond?
Yes. In fact, we have to wrap up the show. Let me let you respond as well as say any final words you'd like to convey with respect to this particular case and what you hope or think it will trigger with regard to the debate over lethal injection as a method for capital punishment and with respect to ramifications for the debate over the merits of the death penalty here in the United States.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me on the show. It's been a pleasure being on with you.
My pleasure as well.
Diane, and let me say something that I know Diane and I will agree on, which is racism in our criminal justice should never occur. And whenever it does occur, it needs to be rooted out and injustices rectified. And that is why there have been many successful appeals, and people who are convicted of capital crimes get direct appeal and several levels, too many in my opinion, of habeas corpus petition reviews. And instances like that are fortunately, at least in my view, I know Diane would disagree with this, are weeded out. And these people are not put to death. I would note, for instance, that since the moratorium has been lifted, although 40% of murderers convicted have been white, they have in fact constituted nearly 65% of those who have been put to death among that nearly 1,400 people that I mentioned. We only touched upon the fact that there are, of course, other methods of execution that are available. Lethal injection is currently the norm. However, there are other states that permit firing squads and gas chamber and execution. And I would note that with respect to a firing squad, for instance, the risk of error is practically impossible. The time of death is far shorter than lethal injection, and studies have indicated that there is no more pain involved in a firing squad than there is in lethal injection. So if lethal injection does prove to be problematic, again, it has not been with respect to a single dosage of pentobarbital, but if the three-drug cocktail, for whatever reason, turns out to be problematic, there are other methods that people can use to soberly and humanely carry out the death penalty.
All right, and the last word to you, Diane Rastierney. Notwithstanding the fact that you are opposed to the death penalty, to talk about other options in terms of methods of execution and to what extent you think this debate over the case in Oklahoma could spark a wider debate over the merits of the death penalty and what other options do you and your organization advocate as punishment for heinous crimes, if not the death penalty?
Let me start by talking about where this event in Oklahoma fits in the debate. And I think it comes at a time where the death penalty is increasingly under fire, and for good reason. We have today the state of New Hampshire considering whether to end the death penalty. And that comes after a number of states have already had this conversation. They've looked at the facts and decided we no longer want the death penalty. And the death penalty is not only becoming increasingly isolated, but it is becoming increasingly disfavored. There are, you know, a handful of states that actually are carrying out executions. And so this is coming at a critical time when we really are asking the question, do we still need to do this? So then as to what we do instead, the first thing I would say is we have to put this in context. We're not talking about the death penalty as if that's the only thing that we do with people who harm other people. I would say in asking this question, we'd have to say, you know, what is the kind of country? What is the kind of society that we want to have? And I say the kind of society that we want to have is one that first focuses on how do we heal? How do we bind up the victims? How do we focus our energy and attention? And one of the things that we found as we look at the states is that those states that are using the death penalty are not doing enough for victims. So that's the first thing. The next thing I would say is, how do we hold people accountable? And holding people accountable means a lot of things. You can't just say, how much evil can we do for the evil that other people do? I think that's why we get to the result in Oklahoma. If we focus on evil for evil, we'd get more evil. If we focus on healing, if we focus on accountability, if we focus on recognizing the humanity and even a person who's done something horrible and helping that person to see that they've done something wrong, that is something that brings light to the kind of society that we want. And so, you know, I don't know about you, but if I do something wrong, when I come to grips with that, I can't rest until I make it right. What if we had a system of holding people accountable in our prisons that made that the reality? So I think let's look at what we want to have. Let's move towards that and not focus on doing evil for evil.
All right. Well, certainly more on this very important topic, the merits of the death penalty here in the United States. We'll be talking about that topic in the months ahead. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Diane Rust Tierney, Executive Director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and John Malcolm, Director of and Senior Legal Fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much to both of you for a great discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.